Well, welcome everybody. I'll turn around this way, say hello. I'm George Alexeyev. I'm now acting director of OEA. So I just wanted to welcome everybody to the perchlorate workshop. And I'm just going to bring everybody's attention to the exit doors. And then there's a restroom down the hallway. So other than that, I'm going to turn it over to Bob Howd, who's going to actually introduce you to the topic and the actual PhD.
So, many of you have come to one of our workshops before, see some happen. All we do is we have this informal session here where we're making your comments. We, in general, won't respond unless you have specific questions that you want to ask us. Craig will be making a short presentation on the PhD just to get us started, and then we open it up to the floor and basically stay as long as you want. And talk and listen to you. So, any questions to get started? Yes.
Is there a transcription of this talk? Or
it is being recorded, and so I would assume that it could be available in what format? Okay, so it's being live broadcast, and the archive will be available where? OEA website? Okay. Very good. So?
So the reason I asked Bob is that in a federal public hearing, sometimes we have an informal sort of information back and forth, and then at some point we say this is now a formal comment hearing. Can you sort of walk us through how?
Yes. Okay. So what we do is we do not respond to the oral comments here. We want your comments in writing, and that's what we respond to. So we have not relied on a written transcript of the comments made here in order to respond to them. So we're not planning on doing that in this case. And that's important. Yes, Kevin, thank you for bringing it up. Anything that you want us to formally respond to should be presented to us in writing so we can do that. So we can make sure that we accurately know what you are saying, are telling us. We're here to listen to anything you have to say. Craig is the author of the document. Our close of comment period is today. However, if something does come up that introduces a new idea to you that you think really needs to be, that we need to consider, send it to us anyway. This is just the first of two comment periods, of course. And we will consider it. We will get around to considering and responding to that comment. So, unless there are further questions, yes, Rick.
Can you just, briefly go over what the process is in general?
The process of?
So, comments are submitted today. When would there be responses to comments?
We don't respond to comments normally until we publish the final PhD. One of the things that we have done is released all written comments upon request, but we don't do formal responses to comments until we work through the process. For hexavalent chromium, we did release intermediate comments. We'd rather not do that. We'd rather make sure that we have a final document and put everything in order at that time. So that would be after a second comment period. And that would has been a 45-day comment period. The next one will be a 30-day comment period, presumably several months away. Anything else? Then, Craig, would you like to talk about the basis of the PhD?
All right, everybody. Thank you for coming. I'm Craig Steinmoss. Obviously, we're talking about perchlorate today. Here's the chemical structure. It's an oxidizing agent used in a variety of industrial processes. Sources of exposure can include industrial contamination, or in some parts of the world, it's naturally occurring in the drinking water. Human exposure can occur through contaminated food or water. And the primary mechanism of toxicity is that perchlorate can competitively inhibit iodide uptake into the thyroid gland. And since iodide is a key component of thyroid hormone, this can potentially lead to a decreased thyroid hormone production. And this just shows some of the potential impacts of decreased thyroid hormone. Severe decreases in thyroid hormone can cause cretinism, goiter, cardiovascular disease. And more subtle changes in thyroid hormone have been linked to changes in lipid metabolism and developmental and cognitive effects on the fetus and children. And this just shows some survey data from the Department of Public Health here in California of the sources and systems in California that had detectable levels of perchlorate. And you can see a fair number of sources and systems. We don't know exactly how many people this is because we don't know how many people are drinking from each source, but you can see a relatively large number of sources, at least during this survey period, that had perchlorate levels above 4 parts per billion. Next slide. So, in establishing the PHG, we used a critical effect of a 5% decrease in iodide uptake into the thyroid gland, and we used this critical effect to derive our benchmark dose. And the benchmark dose was determined using this study by Greer et al. We have one of the authors here. Greer et al. And this was a human dosing study involving 37 human volunteers, daily perchlorate dosing for 2 weeks. 4 separate dose groups you can see down here. And the outcome that was measured was radioactive iodide uptake into the thyroid gland. And you can see as the dose increased, iodide uptake decreased. Next slide. So we used the benchmark dose approach, and we plotted these data using the US EPA benchmark dose software. And we use these data to then calculate the benchmark dose, which was, again, that dose that we estimated to be associated with a 5% decrease in iodide uptake into the thyroid gland. And we, use that to calculate the benchmark dose and the lower 95% confidence interval of that benchmark dose, which is the BMDL. Next slide. And then this just shows some of the variables that we used to calculate the PHG or develop the PHG and compare to the 2004 PHG and the differences. Between the current one and the 2004, you can see it's lower, 1 part per billion. Critical effect, the critical study, the method we use, the benchmark dose method, the BMDL, or the benchmark dose, whether it's 95% confidence interval, were all the same as in 2004. The major differences was the uncertainty factor was increased in infants. Before it was 3, and now it's 10. The relative source contributions changed a little bit. And the drinking water intake, we used updated data on drinking water intake in infants in this one. So it's a little bit higher than it was in 2004. So you can see the major differences are the increase in the uncertainty factor, small change in the relative source contribution, and increase in the drinking water uptake. Those were the major differences. So these are the calculations used to develop the PHG in 2004, and here's the calculations used to develop the proposed PHG. And again, the differences are in 2004, the primary focus was on the fetus and pregnant women, and now, based on new data in infants, we've developed the PHG based on data from infants, including relative source contribution, the uncertainty factor of 10, and the drinking water intake in infants. And you can see these changes here gave us a lower public health goal than in 2004. Okay, next slide. And this just shows some of the reasons why we are now focusing more on the fetus and young children in this proposed PHG. And you can see some of these differences are some of the reasons, including data suggesting that small changes in thyroid hormone levels can lead to significant developmental and cognitive effects in young children. New data showing that infants have, actually this wasn't new data, but we started focusing more on this data showing that infants have relatively low stores of thyroid hormone, meaning that they may be more susceptible to transient increases or decreases in iodine uptake or thyroid hormone levels. And then new data suggesting that people with low iodine intakes are particularly susceptible to the thyroid effects of perchlorate, and new data showing that many infants probably are not getting enough iodine in their diet. And then new data from the US EPA showing the high drinking water intake per body weight in young children and infants, and several epidemiological studies that have linked relatively low perchlorate exposures to thyroid hormone levels. So these are all the reasons why we're now focusing on infants in the proposed pH shoot. Okay, that's it. Thank you.
And so we're open for comments. Anybody like to start? Feel free. And please introduce yourself.
So my name is Dr. Rebecca Sutton, and I represent Environmental Working Group, which is a public health research and advocacy nonprofit. We're based in DC and here in Oakland, just a few blocks away. So I always enjoy giving comments that are congratulatory to public health agencies and other scientists. And so I'm here today to express strong support for the proposal to lower the public health goal for perchlorate from 6 to 1 part per billion. We reviewed the proposal. We think it's very appropriate and, in fact, overdue, considering the extensive body of evidence that you just reviewed on the effects of perchlorate on the thyroid hormone levels and, in particular, on the risks it may pose to the youngest Californians. In particular, we definitely support the decision to look at infant water consumption and body weight for this proposed change, given the latest research indicating that infants are the ones at highest risk. And we definitely support the uncertainty factor of 10 to account for the fact that the Greer study is based on adults, whereas we're looking at infants here. Now, of course, to be truly health protective, we think the public health goal should be even lower. We would really prefer to see it relying on the CDC study, which documents thyroid effects on a large chronically exposed population, including over 300 pregnant women, as opposed to the Greer study, which is just on 37 healthy adults and only exposed them for 2 weeks. And in future reviews of this public health goal, we believe OEHA will need to incorporate a more realistic relative source contribution, as it seems that we may be eating more perchlorate than is currently assumed. Basically, summary, we're really pleased with this change. We strongly support a public health goal of 1 part per billion. We recognize that it's a middle ground decision, since alternative approaches could have resulted in a lower value. Oh, and we submitted these via email already, but.
Yeah, I think we got them, but I'm happy to accept them. Sure. Thank you. Anyone else?
Good morning. My name is Andrea Ventura. I'm here with Clean Water Action. We have approximately 85,000 members here in California. We are a national organization. And many of those members live in perchlorate-impacted communities. And we, too, want to congratulate OEHA for its sound scientific analysis. We think that you've done a very thorough job, and we do support this proposal. We certainly praise you're looking at the increase in the uncertainty factor from 3 to 10, as well as the impacts on infants and fetuses, including their water intake. We, as I said, we work with people who are living in impacted communities. We see pregnant women walk into the door at meetings. We see them with their children. We see their children drinking water, and we're very concerned with that. So we do support this. We would hope that OEHA will be able to go through the public process that you've laid out, and we'll be able to finalize this as quickly as possible. We certainly hope that you will be allowed to do that, because we do think that your scientific analysis is sound and warrants that. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Danielle, did you have something you would like to say?
No, I think our written comments are going to be.
Yes, very good, yes. I agree, we've got those. Rick?
I think from Interfox's perspective, we have a number of scientific comments that we've submitted or will be submitting today for your consideration. that looking to a number of the components of the developed the direct PSG subjective comments address more questions.
Fine, yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm Larry Cummings. I'm chair of the PSG, and I submitted those comments to that team to the work later.
Oh, very good.
Very good.
Checking this in.
Uh-huh. And they are in, did you send them electronically too?
They will be coming electronically before the day is open.
Oh, very good. Excellent, excellent. Kevin, you want to say something? Just to liven things up? This is Kevin Meyer of US EPA Region 9.
Yes, US EPA is looking at their own review of the scientific information. It was announced on February 2nd that US EPA would be developing a drinking water standard for the chlorine. I understand that the scientists involved with that are still in their process, so EPA will not make a formal comment on the science of the public health role. However, I have, as you know, Region 9 is very interested in the state's deliberations on a public health goal for chlorine, since oftentimes it's our projects in interaction with the state that involves cleanup of contaminated water supplies in the state of California, as well as the rest of the region and the rest of the country. So thank you very much for your expression of your thinking on the analysis of the water toxicity.
Very good. Yes, Rick?
Maybe just if I can have a follow-up question. Can I ask follow-up questions about the presentation?
Do anything you like.
Is that possible? Just as...
Why don't you use the microphone? Yes. Are you cast? And then...
Sure.
Rick Floyce, Intertox. Craig, Dr. Steinmoss, you mentioned the shift between the pregnant woman, I think, and the infant. Can you just, and you listed a number of those points there. I'm wondering if you could go into a little bit more depth on those, in particular the epidemiological studies, I think, that were listed on that.
Okay. Can we go to the very last slide? So, again, just to get to the epidemiological studies, you know, I think there's a lot of controversy about each one of these individual studies. And I you know, none of them in and of itself is absolute proof that low perchlorate exposures affect thyroid hormone levels. However, we look at all of the evidence and the weight of the evidence. And in epidemiology, we never rely on a single study. We rely on trends across studies and consistencies across studies. Again, looking at the epidemiology, that's just one piece of everything that we've looked at. The other pieces are, again, the things shown here. This link between low iodine and perchlorate in causing thyroid hormone decreases. And, you know, that's a biologically plausible mechanism based on what we know about how perchlorate works. Again, this new information from Elizabeth Pierce showing that many infants probably are not getting adequate iodine intakes, so that would make them particularly susceptible to perchlorate. Again, a variety of studies, not just one, not just two, but five or six or seven, showing that even small changes in thyroid hormone have been linked to pretty significant impacts on cognitive development and IQ in the offspring of pregnant women that have these small shifts in thyroid hormone levels. So all that data combined has led us to focus on susceptibility in infants. No one thing, everything combined. Does that answer your question, Rick?
Yeah, no, I think you gave me a little bit more information about it.
We acknowledge that there's a lot of things that inhibit iodine uptake, and perchlorate is just one of them, and not actually the biggest one. The nitrate that we're all getting in, most of us getting in drinking water, and thiocyanate, the co-inhibitors, are all relevant, we think, and we have to consider the whole homeostasis system in this particular risk assessment. Yes, sir. Go ahead, Rick.
Okay. Do you want me to go back up to the
issue? Sure.
It's like we're having a discussion.
Sure.
Bob, I think that's an interesting question, and the document, the draft document, doesn't seem to put a lot of emphasis on other goitrogens. How did you reconcile those 2 points? Because that's a good point that you bring up.
Well, the important point is that we haven't that thiocyanate is not a regulated chemical in drinking water, so we haven't done a full analysis of that, and that we're just in the process of redoing the nitrate, which hadn't been reviewed with this in mind at all. This is the first our developing public health goal for nitrate will be the first time that this, that I know of, that this has been comprehensively covered for regulatory risk assessment. So we simply didn't have the data and didn't have the background in order to adequately discuss that with the perchlorate risk assessment. And this is a thing that all of us in drinking water will have to be incorporating into our thinking more. Go ahead.
When speaking of nitrate, when would you expect that assessment to be released?
I hope we can get the nitrate out for public comment this year.
They use the Tonacera data for that? Is that how you pronounce that?
No, I call it Tonacera, but I don't know if I'm
right. Right. I'm not convinced that the data from that study actually applies to what's actually going on in the human body and the human thyroid. If I remember right, that was human cells or other cells with the human NIS? Right. In a lab dish. Not in a human. That's why I'm not convinced that what's going on in that lab dish actually goes on in the human thyroid.
Or to be more complete, in the human body. Nobody, you're not fighting anybody.
You have all the good questions.
If we go back to the epidemiological studies for just a second, I think actually, Craig, you had published a study in December, I think, on FSH, CSH in newborns. But I think you then did a reanalysis of a number of other studies as well. Can you talk a little bit more about that process?
Well, I'll talk about my paper in relationship to the paper that I, the data that I reanalyzed, which was Pat Buffler's paper, where she found no effect and I found an effect. I did two things that were different. One is I included TSH levels that were collected in the first 24 hours of birth. She didn't use those. She said that the spike in TSH makes an analysis of TSH levels in that first 24 hours invalid. And I disagree with that. I don't see why that would be invalid, why that would invalidate any results. The other thing is she used a very high TSH cutoff level as defining her high TSH. It was the 99.96th percentile, so very high. I looked at that cutoff point, but I also looked at the 95% percentile as defining a high TSH. And the reason why I did that is because some of these studies that I had sort of mentioned up here in the first line, they found significant effects on childhood IQ with women that have TSH levels in that sort of 95 percentile level. So based on those two things, I found an effect, whereas she didn't. So that's the major difference between the two. I'm looking at lower levels, and I'm including TSH levels within the first 24 hours of birth.
You mentioned that there's that spike which occurs, you know, during the first 24 hours. There's pretty much in the first couple of hours, I think it starts to trend upwards, and then the values actually can be quite high from my understanding, it can be 100 units, possibly even higher, and then they drop back down over time towards whatever the normal value for that child would be.
Yeah, they actually peak at about 2 hours.
Certainly during the prenatal period, the TSH levels and the thyroid hormone levels and T4, T3, pre-T4, things like that, they're actually they change rather robustly through the prenatal period. And then postnatal, there's that surge when they kind of work themselves out, if you will. But we really have quite a dynamic period. One of the questions that the literature seems to talk about is not only that dynamic period, which I think is a tough thing to catch, if you will, just because of the changes occur so quickly. But another one is the fact that at birth, there's different gestational ages, and the literature is pretty clear about how important that is. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, a couple things. One is, yeah, so, you know, in the first 24 hours or 48 hours, you're going to have a lot of variability in TSH levels because of that spike. But that variability will bias towards not finding an effect. It won't bias towards finding a false effect. So that's number one. It's non-differential misclassification of outcome, biases towards the null. That's a classic standard principle of epidemiology. Okay, that's number one. Your other point was
different gestational ages.
Yeah, we have no reason to believe that that's going to be different in perchlorate-exposed communities versus unexposed communities. A variable has to be associated with the exposure and the outcome. That's associated with the outcome. We have no reason to believe it's associated with the exposure to perchlorate. So it wouldn't be a confounding variable. It has to be associated with both.
Don't most state programs not use the first 24-hour TSH just because it is so variable that they can't even evaluate an infant's thyroid within the first 24 hours based on TSH?
Yeah, but those state programs make those rules because they're looking at primary congenital hypothyroidism, which is a very severe disease, and it's looking at a very high TSH level. They're not; those rules are not aimed at evaluating the effects of environmental chemicals on TSH levels. So it's completely different. So you can't use those rules that you just mentioned and apply them to what we're doing, what we did looking at an environmental chemical. Two separate things. think the other interesting point is that, again, in our paper, we see this effect, this difference between perchlorate-exposed and unexposed communities in the first 24 hours, and the effect continues until 48 hours. And then the differences between the THF levels after 48 hours goes away. So some people could say, well, it's only a transient temporary effect. However, the question you have to ask yourself is, it goes away after 48 hours. Who are those infants having their TSH levels measured after 48 hours? In California, most normal vaginal deliveries, they're going to be out of the hospital in 48 hours. So they're going to have their TSH levels measured in the first 48 hours. So the people after 48 hours, the babies after 48 hours, they're the ones that had complications, they had C-sections. They are this sort of, I hate to use the word abnormal group, but they are not the normal child. So it's not really fair to look at these people that had neonatal TSH levels measured after 48 hours. And I would say that the most valid TSH measurements are the ones before 48 hours where we saw an effect.
I think you're talking about figure 1 in your paper, you're talking about odds ratios.
Yes.
Did it go past 48 hours?
It went past 48 hours, and after 48 hours, the odds ratio started going towards 1.
But it was still over 1, I remember that right.
It was very variable after 48 hours because the number of infants was small, and so the odds ratio was actually unstable after 48 hours. So it went up and down.
One question I would have is, what was it, the mother's home address?
Right.
Is that correct?
Correct.
And then they went to the hospital.
Correct.
And then they delivered. And then whenever the measure was taken,
right,
it was going to be variable by anything. But before they left the hospital.
Right.
With the half-life of perchlorate at about 8 hours, wouldn't you expect the perchlorate levels to start to decrease?
Yes, and all the more reason to look at those TSH levels that were collected within 24 hours. Because after 24 hours, yes, you'll probably have some exposure misclassification. You'll probably have infants that consume some... the mother's consumed water or the infant's consumed formula with water from the hospital, so it'll no longer represent what was at the residence. So as time goes on, you'll get more misclassification of exposure. So you should check the TSH levels within the first 24 hours, when the perchlorate levels probably more represent what happened at the residence. Perchlorate's not going to go, the mother goes to the hospital. Perchlorate's not going to go out of her system, in a minute. It's going to last. Even if the half-life is 8 hours, after 8 hours, perchlorate's still going to be there, some of it. Right? It's not going to go away at 8 hours. So it'll gradually go away. It won't go away right away. So.
But what I'm saying is in that first 24 hours, let's just use that 24-hour period, that's not...
Right. Yeah. It's probably still has some perchlorate from the home source. Again, the perchlorate's not going to go away right when the baby's born or right when the mother goes to the hospital. It's not going to go away. There'll still be some perchlorate left. So, yes. We have some exposure misclassification. Probably gets worse as time goes on. But again, non-differential exposure misclassification biases towards the null. It'll decrease any finding we see. It won't cause a false effect. So.
Okay. If we're silent, we can quietly leave, but happy to stay and hear anybody else's comments. that we'll want to write anything else. Okay, then let us break up. Thank you all for coming. And if we were to get any comments, we request to have the comments released after we all release the comments on our website so that we can all see what other people have contributed for this discussion. Yes, Kevin.
What determines the start of the second comment period?
When we get, when we go through all the comments, we figure out how to address them all. We update the draft in response to all of the comments. Then we say, okay, we're ready to release it for the second comment period. Depending upon the nature and extent of comments in the literature, of course, that comes out during the period of our preparation for the draft and finalizing the second draft, that will require a different amount of time. Okay, thank you all for coming.